This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear. Nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran seizes 2 Greek oil tankers in the Persian Gulf days after the seizure of an Iranian oil cargo by Greece. The US targets North Korea with a new set of sanctions after China and Russia blocked its push for more sanctions at the United Nations. Plus, US police are facing criticism over their delayed response to the school shooting in Texas and why they failed to engage in time to save more lives. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has seized 2 Greek oil tankers in the Persian Gulf waters south of the country. In a statement, the IRGC said the vessels were seized for, quote, violations committed. According to shipping sources, Swiss Max's Delta Poseidon and Prudent Warrior had both loaded at Basra port in Iraq. The latter was carrying an oil cargo for the US. The incident comes just days after Greece seized the oil cargo of an Iranian-flagged tanker, and moved to deliver the crude to the United States. The Iranian Foreign Ministry has already summoned the Swiss and Greek chargé d'affaires over the issue. Switzerland represents U.S. interests in Iran. The ministry slammed the U.S. violation of international law and maritime conventions governing free navigation and trade. It has also demanded the immediate release of the seized ship and its cargo. Political commentator Said Mohammed Morandi believes by seizing the Greek-flagged tankers, Tehran is sending a message to Washington and its allies, warning them against harming Iran's oil trade.
Well, I think it's quite obvious. The Iranians are sending a message to NATO that if you touch our oil, you will pay the price, and the price of it will go through the roof. The market is very tight. There is a shortage of oil, and the world economy is heading towards a major recession. So if the Americans and the Europeans want to make the situation much worse, then they could continue pushing the globe towards further tension. If they want to ease the oil market, then the only way forward is to respect international law and their piracy, and to refrain from touching Iranian oil, Iranian assets, and which include Iranian tankers and super tankers.
Turning elsewhere now, the United States has hit North Korea with new sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs. The U.S. Treasury Department says it has blacklisted two Russian banks and a North Korean company and an individual. It said Washington would continue to implement sanctions but urged the North to return to a diplomatic path. The move came a day after China and Russia vetoed a U.S.-led push for more United Nations sanctions over North Korea's missile launches. In a joint statement later, the US, Japan, and South Korea strongly condemned the North's recent ballistic missile launches. Talks on Pyongyang's denuclearization have been stalled since a summit with the US collapsed in 2019. North Korea says its nuclear and missile programs are to counter hostile US policies. And North Korea reports a drop in the number of new fever cases as it battles its first ever COVID outbreak since the beginning of the pandemic. Local media say over 88,500 people showed fever symptoms on Friday. The figure dropped to below 100,000 for the first time since North Korea began reporting daily new cases on May 12. No additional deaths have been registered. So far, the country has logged over 3.4 million fever cases and 69 deaths. 2 weeks ago, Pyongyang declared a state of emergency and imposed a national lockdown after it confirmed its first COVID cases. The government says the COVID outbreak is now under control. The U.S. Special Rapporteur, in his visit to Afghanistan, has warned about humanitarian and economic crises in the country. Richard Bennett has called on the international community to continue to provide humanitarian support to Afghanistan in order to protect the Afghan people in the face of sanctions on the Taliban. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from Kabul.
The UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Afghanistan has concluded his 11-day trip to the country. Holding a press conference in Kabul, Richard Bennett expressed concern about the violation of human rights in Afghanistan, calling on the Taliban to abide by their promises.
Afghanistan is facing a plethora of critical human rights challenges that are having a severe impact on the population. I urge the authorities to acknowledge the human rights challenges that they are facing and to close the gap between their words and their deeds.
Mr. Bennett also called for investigation into blind terror attacks in the country, saying systematic attacks on Shia Hazaras involve marks of crimes against humanity.
I call for investigations into a series of attacks on places of worship and schools in Kabul, Kunduz, and Balkh provinces, instances of which have been claimed by the ISISK group. In particular, such attacks specifically targeting members of the Hazara, Shia, and Sufi communities are becoming increasingly systematic in nature and reflect elements of an organizational policy, thus bearing the hallmarks of crimes against humanity.
The UN expert also urged the international community to continue relief funds to Afghanistan, saying sanctions on the Taliban should not harm the Afghan people.
The humanitarian and economic crisis is very concerning, and I call on the international community to continue to provide humanitarian support and to ensure that the implementation of applicable sanctions do not substantially impede the provision of essential public services accessible to all, which are necessary for the enjoyment of human rights.
The independent expert advised the Taliban to form an inclusive government and establish fair engagement with the people if they want to end instability and suffering on Afghan soil. The UN expert's trip to Afghanistan comes as the country has been facing rights violations in different aspects. Afghan people hope their rights are protected and the international community closely watches developments in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Anger is boiling in the United States over the fatal recent shooting at a Texas school. Hundreds of protesters converge on the annual convention of the power fund lobbying group, the National Rifle Association, in Houston.
They have had enough time to fix this problem, and they've only made it worse. What are we going to do?
The demonstrators held signs and chanted slogans demanding stricter gun control laws as the association's members gathered for the convention. The NRA has faced criticism for deciding to hold the gathering. Activists say it should have rather held a memorial ceremony for the victims of the school shooting. On Tuesday, an 18-year-old shooter massacred 19 children and two teachers at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas. The incident has also raised the criticism of the police, with officials acknowledging that officers were slow to take action.
Hey, from the benefit of hindsight, where I'm sitting now, of course it was not the right decision. It was the wrong decision, period. There's no excuse for that. But again, I wasn't there, but I'm just telling you, from what we know, we believe there should have been an entry at that as soon as you can.
The official added that the police received several emergency calls reporting that 8 or 9 children were still alive while the shooting was underway. Despite that, officers held back from making an entry for over half an hour, and this has sparked fears that such instances of police inaction could cost lives during active shootings. The Cuban president has accused the U.S. of hegemonic practices after Washington handpicked Latin American states for the summit of the Americas.
The practice of exclusion is not new and confirms the United States' interest in controlling the inter-American system for hegemonic purposes and imposing its power to oversee democracy. This right does not correspond to them politically or morally. They claim to be promoters of democracy, which they deliberately confuse with their own system, but are unable to guarantee a plural space.
Miguel Diaz-Canel made the comments during a meeting of the 11-country Alba Bloc in Cuba. He had earlier announced that he would not attend the Summit of the Americas, which is scheduled for June. The U.S. has officially said it will not invite Venezuela and Nicaragua. Washington claims that the Venezuelan government is illegitimate and accuses the Nicaraguan president of authoritarianism. The U.S. has faced criticism for its decision, with several Latin American leaders threatening to boycott the events. Russia takes control of the railroad hub of Lyman as part of an assault aimed at capturing the last Ukrainian-held area in the eastern Donbass region. Pro-Russians say they have been in full control of Lyman. Ukrainian officials acknowledge that Russia captured most of the town. Ukraine's defense ministry says its forces are still blocking the Russians from launching an advance towards the nearby city of Sloviansk. Ukrainian officials say Russian forces have encircled two-thirds of Severodonetsk, the biggest city held by Ukraine in the Donbass. Despite the Russian advances on the two major fronts in the Donbass, Ukraine says its forces still hold new defensive lines there. Russia's operation in Ukraine was launched in late February.
This is the road to Svetlodarsk, a town in Donbass recently taken by the Russian army and separatist militias.
We've stopped just outside the town, Ukrainian positions. There used to be Ukrainian positions, but they've now left. I've been told to take off my press identification on my vest here because if there are snipers, they may well target journalists.
The town is home to around 10,000 people, most of whom stayed during the fighting. I'm surprised to see little damage here.
Nothing happened, fortunately, in the town itself. But the joint forces of the DPR, LPR, and Russia broke the so-called Svetlodarsk Arc, and the enemy lost all interest in fighting and left, so the battle is now behind the town. Kiev do not give their army enough motivation. We are on our land, and we're defending it. And at the moment, we're going forward. They are on foreign land.
Up on this plinth, in this square here, there would have been a Russian statue. My translator think it may have been a statue of Lenin, but the Ukrainians have been pulling down these statues, trying to erase any Russian culture or signs of Russian culture in areas they take. But now this is back under Russian control, this town.
These last 8 years, we've been living under humiliation. And when the Russian soldiers came, we've been waiting for them. For we are also Russians. We understand Russians. We think and live like Russians do. That's why we were waiting for them.
First of all, I think it will be easier to breathe. We do not understand yet. Our fear is that the Russian military will move on and leave the town without defense, and that we will be under shelling again.
There will be people in this town who do not welcome the Russian soldiers here, who are more pro-Ukrainian, but either they have fled or they might be worried about saying that out loud. It's clear that the majority of people here anyway welcome the Russian soldiers.
I am taken to a townhouse which served as a Ukrainian military base, the remnants of what the soldiers left as they fled. They tried to hide tanks here, but the building was still struck by a Russian airstrike.
Now these are pictures drawn by children, quite possibly sent to the Ukrainian soldiers. These ones here say, "We want peace." This one here says, "Please return alive."
As the Russian army continues their advance in Donbass, more towns like this, in the coming days and weeks, will raise the Russian flag. Meanwhile, civilians throughout the Donbass, whether pro-Russian or pro-Ukrainian, will be hoping that this war will soon come to an end. Johnny Miller, Svetlodarsk.
Italy's two-time Prime Minister Romano Prodi has expressed serious concerns over the consequences associated with the Ukraine-Russia conflict. Prodi has warned the sanctions against Moscow would cost a lot, mainly to Italy, Germany and the European Union.
On Friday, two-time Prime Minister of Italy and former President of the European Union, Romano Prodi, had his say on the Ukraine crisis and subsequent geopolitical developments during a meeting with journalists held at the International Press Association headquarters in Rome, known for having overseen an extensive privatization of Italy's public assets and for his lack of ostentation. Prodi is today a retired politician. He expressed serious concerns at how the sanctions imposed against Russia over the conflict in Ukraine will reverberate through the European Union, with the risk of creating divisions among the members of the bloc.
The Ukraine crisis fallout will hit the EU badly. Sanctions would cost a lot to Italy and Germany, less to other EU countries. Brussels has reacted unitedly to Russia, but peace must remain paramount.
Italy and Germany are the countries which have relied on Russian energy the most over the past 20 years. Rome has been trying to diversify its energy sources, but it will take at least 2-3 years before it achieves a total replacement of Russian gas. Since the start of the war in Ukraine, Rome has been trying to wean itself off Russian gas. However, according to the National Bureau of Statistics, is that Italy's imports from Russia rose around 120% in value in April, while Italian exports to Russia showed an annual fall of almost 50% in the same period. Max Civili, Rome.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
In an advertisement released last year, Blake Masters, a leading candidate in Arizona's Republican Senate primary, cradles a semi-automatic weapon. This is a short-barreled rifle, he said. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times opinion columnist Michelle Goldberg. The piece is titled, America May Be Broken Beyond Repair. Advertisement released last year, Blake Masters, a leading candidate in Arizona's Republican Senate primary, cradles a semi-automatic weapon. This is a short-barreled rifle, he said, ominous music playing in the background. It wasn't designed for hunting. This is designed to kill people. For Blake Masters, this isn't an argument against allowing such guns to proliferate. Rather, it's an acknowledgement of why access to these weapons is, for the right, a matter of existential importance. The Second Amendment is not about duck hunting, said Masters. It's about protecting your family and your country. What's the first thing that the Taliban did when Joe Biden handed them Afghanistan? They took away people's guns. Guns, in this worldview, are a guarantor against government overreach, and government overreach includes attempts to regulate guns. These days, it's barely remarkable when Republicans issue what sounds like threats against those who dare curtail their private arsenals. I have news for the embarrassment that claims to be our president. Try to take our guns and you'll learn why the Second Amendment was written in the first place. Randy Fine, a state representative in Florida, tweeted on Wednesday. It will be impossible to do anything about guns in this country, at least at a national level, as long as Democrats depend on the cooperation of a party that holds in reserve the possibility of insurrection. The slaughter of children in Texas has done little to alter this dynamic. Republicans have no intention of letting Democrats pass even modest measures, like strengthened background checks, as long as the Democratic senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema refuse to amend the filibuster. Republicans retain a veto over national policy. Victims of our increasingly frequent mass shootings are collateral damage in a cold civil war, though some Democrats refuse to acknowledge it, let alone fight it. Fine's words echoed Donald Trump's during the 2016 presidential election, when he said that Second Amendment people might be able to stop a President Hillary Clinton from appointing Supreme Court justices. What was once a barely concealed insinuation of violence has morphed, especially since 6 of January 2021, into an even more forthright menace. As ProPublica has reported, dozens of members of the Oath Keepers militia were arrested in connection with the attack on the Capitol. But that hasn't stopped the organization from evolving into a force within the Republican Party. In Shasta County, a conservative part of rural Northern California, a militia-aligned faction has secured a majority on the Board of Supervisors in what members of the movement see as a blueprint that can be deployed nationally. Throughout the country, reported the New York Times, right-wing Republicans are talking more openly and frequently about the use of force as justifiable in opposition to those who dislodged him, meaning Donald Trump, from power. Expecting those same Republicans to collaborate with Democrats on public safety is madness. The horrifying irony, the hideous ratchet, is that the more America is besieged by senseless violence, the more the paramilitary wing of the American right is strengthened. Gun sales in America tend to rise after mass shootings. Republicans responded to the massacre in Uvalde, Texas, by doubling down on calls to arm teachers and harden schools. An article in The Federalist argued that parents must homeschool so that kids can't learn in a controlled environment where guns can be safely carried for self-defense or locked away when not in use. It's a vision of a society, if we can call it that, where every family is a fortress. Guns are now the leading cause of death for American children, but many conservatives consider this a price worth paying for their version of freedom. Our institutions give these conservatives disproportionate power, whether or not they win elections. The filibuster renders the Senate largely impotent. Donald Trump, a former president who lost the popular vote, was able to appoint Supreme Court justices who are poised to help overturn a New York State law restricting the carrying of concealed weapons. It's increasingly hard to see a path to small-d democratic reform. And so among liberals, there's an overwhelming feeling of despair, even as people learn the names of all those murdered children. The most common sentiment is not never again, but a bitter acknowledgement that nothing is going to change. America is too sick. It is too broken. It is perhaps beyond repair. 2 years ago, David French, an anti-Trump conservative, published a book, Divided We Fall, warning of the possible crack-up of the United States. It included 2 chapters imagining scenarios for how the dissolution of the country might happen. One scenario involved a mass shooting at a school in California, to which the state's people reacted with white-hot rage. David French envisioned furious state politicians defying the Second Amendment, leading to a nullification crisis and blue state secession. He meant it as a cautionary tale, but rereading the chapter after Uvalde, Texas, it feels less bleak than our reality. In David French's scenario, atrocity has the effect of energizing people rather than immobilizing them. They are determined to fight, not resigned to defeat. They have audacity and hope. The real nightmare is not that the repetition of nihilist terrorism brings American politics to an inflection point, but that it doesn't. The nightmare is that we simply stumble on, helpless, as things keep getting worse. English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio. Of women.
The Gaza Strip has been suffering a crisis and difficult humanitarian circumstances. Israel started 2 wars on Gaza that resulted in destroying the infrastructure and ruining most fields. Israel has been imposing a siege on the Strip for more than 7 years, in addition to blocking the crossings and preventing people from traveling. Palestinian women played a significant role in highlighting these issues in media.
This indicates that the Palestinian society is developed and knows the importance of media. It was introduced to it in a miserable condition, as Israel is imposing a blockade and encroaching the Palestinians. Therefore, there must be a Palestinian reaction to document this situation. So, the Palestinians' media was the first to play the role in this field by graduating a Palestinian generation that is aware of what happens.
Practically, the beginning of journalism and production companies in the Gaza Strip witnessed a difficulty in women engagement. I can say that I lived 2 eras. The first was at the age of 16, which was too early and media was not developed. After that, people got used to intensive presence of media, women working there, and partnership between both genders. Why did it become normal? It was because the society realized that media is the base in the life of a society like Palestinians. We are the owners of a cause. This cause is only expressed to the whole world through media.
We started with the number of 100, then 200 after a few years. The number was constant for 4 to 5 years until 3 years ago. There were 650 students. Now there are 1,100 students enrolled in the Faculty of Journalism. The female students were forming 50% of the total number in the past years. However, it became 60 to 62%. And the rest are male students.
We receive applications of joining the journalist syndicate every day, especially of female journalism graduates. Female members of the syndicate are nearly 30% in whole Palestine and 25% in Gaza. This number is a good one for them as females.
Arab women in general suffer, in an Eastern society, from some traditions and beliefs that prevent them from working in certain careers. One of these careers is media and journalism. However, Palestinian women, in particular, were distinguished with making some breakthroughs. They achieved tangible success in careers related to radio and television in general, either as camera women, video editors, producers, directors, or anchors.
We as journalists are capable of delivering our message to the world through the culture and the mind energy we have. This happens through what happens around us and what we live. The University of Palestine has more than one major of media. There are public relations, interpretation, electronic journalism, and radio and television. This way, students have the opinion to choose one of these majors with what suits their environment and interests.
When I first studied media, I knew that I would have to go out many times, and there are some surprising things that may happen. Especially that here, in the Gaza Strip, there may suddenly happen bombing or breaking into the strip or something like that. I know that my work requires that I be ready any time.
No doubt the female journalist students in the Gaza Strip could get the respect and admiration of the society and its support in different ways. This includes families and other parts of society. For female journalists, their career is respected among society and is not similar to any other career.
This is a full-time job that requires time and effort. I use my time here to produce some dramas that embody the reality we live and some social series. These series may be comedies or patriotic.
Indicators of the situation in Gaza Strip are frightening. Unprecedented levels of poverty, unemployment, and dependence on aid have put so much pressure on Gazans.
I started my work about 8 years ago as a TV correspondent. As soon as I started, there has been a lot of difficulties, mainly the political situation. Working as a journalist in general, or a correspondent in particular, has its own difficulties. I'm a mother of four, and of course, coming to work, you always face the difficulties of coming to work, the threats everybody else here is facing, plus having to leave my children home alone. Well, it takes a lot of effort. I mean, I have to work extra hours sometimes, and my kids have to give in on a lot of things. I mean, I don't cook all the time, that's one thing, but they have gotten used to the lifestyle. Plus, our work is difficult when it's, you know, the season is hot, when there are war. Other times I have, you know, some easier times, but so it's give and take.
صعب على فتاة أن تقتحم مجال خصوصا في بلد ساخن.
It's hard for a woman to work in this field, especially in a country that lives many proceedings and a conservative society. The beginning was hard, but at the end I proved myself and succeeded. I have proven that what I'm doing is a patriotic duty. Practically, if I manage work and home together, I can be successful in both. However, managing both comes at the expense of losing my comfort and psychological relief and even sleep hours.
Photography is maybe one of the most difficult media arts. That's because a woman is carrying her camera and taking photos like what other male journalists do. She exerts efforts and tries to be the number one. Thus, the way society looks at this was harsh at the beginning. They didn't accept that. But we overcame that now, and they started facilitating the female journalist mission and providing support. Some people knew my name and missed me, especially during the clashes of East Jabalia, as I was the only female shooting there. They're contacting me on Facebook and asking me where my visit is. They also offer help in case I can't go there. At the beginning of my career, the first challenge was my father, brothers, and my husband inquiring about what I'm doing. I was able to prove myself and make them change their attitude. The pressure was big, that I was a mother and studying and working the same time. I had to manage these things without losing any of the three sides.
I was living in hard circumstances lately because I was doing my master's. That made me leave home for long hours, sometimes 12 hours. For sure, that affected me psychologically and physically. It also influenced my family, including my daughter and husband and my social life.
Luckily enough, I haven't faced any difficulties as a woman. I mean, Palestinians are used to women being always part of the life, the struggle. They have always been there, whether as political participants or working in all different fields. So I haven't faced any difficulties. I mean, the Palestinian society accepts the woman as part of it, so they even support us.
Nowadays, there is great development of the society's attitude to a female journalist. It became the opposite, as they would help and excuse her when she's late for home. Of course, there are exceptions. However, essentially, a successful female journalist takes care of herself and takes the society's traditions into consideration. This way, she will be respected, as I experienced.
One of the tiring things is that I'm pregnant and about to deliver a baby. It's possible to have the delivery symptoms any moment, but I'm still working. Despite everything, I'm happy that I'm working in my field and serving my nation and society. It's a national duty I should do.
To be a journalist in Gaza, working under aggressions, pressure, bad situation, financial cases of a humanitarian crisis gives you courage and a big power and strong points, beliefs, methods to do and achieve more and more and more. And this is very important for my job right now, to prove that you are strong to be here in this position.
My first experience in war covering was disastrous and sad because it was hard to see casualties and martyrs of your nation. However, it was a big challenge for me that I could prove myself in the field. Other journalists were helpful as I was moving with them in their vehicles. We used to move together whenever there was bombing or shelling to the location. I challenged myself to hold back my tears in front of the martyrs' families and the fragments of children's bodies. Similar things happened during the funeral of al-Darju children. I fainted after trying to touch their dead bodies. As a mother, I was strongly affected, and then I got over it.
We experience exceptional circumstances in Gaza. Anytime Israeli forces may break into the strip or bomb it, We may have clashes with the army. So I need to be ready and present anytime, ready to leave home to work to cover the news. This requires effort and time of what I say for my family.
I have just graduated from university and I started working before that. I was working at more than one place. I was an announcer in addition to other things. Besides that, I was a student and had a life. Society is divided into categories according to people's attitude to a working woman in general, and a female journalist in particular. For example, some people are open-minded and respect female journalists because their job is tiring. They have enough of work pressure, are in front of the camera and under different kinds of pressure. Some other people have another viewpoint. A woman cannot appear on TV as an announcer in an Eastern conservative Arab society. She cannot get dressed in certain ways and cannot be on TV from the first place.
The Women's Affairs Center in the Gaza Strip is concerned with media. It has a unit for television production and documentary movies. Many young Palestinian women start their careers from this place. The center organizes media courses regularly to improve the skills of the trainees so that they become able to work in this field.
The Women's Affairs Center has started training since 1995. We started our own activities by a Canadian producer who trained a group of 15 girls. It was a year and a half of training on documentary production. However, we first renovated the center, implemented for the strategic planning. Then we started a 200-hour training course for some young women who wanted to learn production, shooting, and editing. Our first experience included 12 young women. Then the next year, the number increased to be 20. A year after, the applications were about 100. And we started holding entrance exams and other exams for the candidates. We would also select the best trainees and the ones we feel they would carry on in this field.
I chose to join the Women's Affairs Center by a recommendation of a friend. I was recommended to join it to grow the talent I already have, which is production and television. I went there and registered for training courses for a year and a half. Then, at the end of this year, a movie was produced, or it was a documentary that was done as a production experience.
Here is a group of young women who are being trained in many kinds of television skills, like voice, filming, lighting, and production.
We asked the center to hold these courses because we needed a staff for dramas in the movie. We wanted to know how to create drama in the movie, so it was not a regular shooting. It had to be professional.
I'm the camerawoman of drama and documentary films. I was the camerawoman of Notice and The Ways, two drama films. I'm also one of the editors of the film Where Are My Stuff?
From the first places, I grew up in a sports house and was brought up doing sports. My family was and is still supporting me. They are the ones who encouraged me in this field. This has made me more courageous and honest. My father, may Allah grant him health, is the one who advises me and discusses everything with me. My father and I are close friends, and I consult him about everything. He tells me what to do without being persistent.
Actually, my family is very proud of me. I worked on the movie Hope Remains a Title and won first place, and that was the first movie I won first place for in the Cinema and Art Production Festival. Since then, everyone started supporting me and telling me what to do. They gave me the choice to go anywhere.
There's a story for my journey. Leaving home to office means traveling from east the strip to the west. This path was a minefield for me. As soon as I reached my office, I went on air and reported news happening on my way there. There were cars bombed on my way and citizens killed. One time, Israel hit a market on the same road, Omar al-Mukhtar Street. So the way itself was a story for me. Leaving home and reaching office was martyrdom. Reaching office meant I had a new life. During the war, we didn't know the source of the shelling. There was shelling by tanks, planes, and boats. That was a really wild war, as the only people moving in streets were either fighters or journalists. Press men were bombed either by targeting their vehicles or their offices. We were targeted in Al Alam Channel, or media group company, with a rocket during work. They didn't consider the existence of journalists in the place, though there were press signs like TV press. The targets were journalists who represent media, and they wanted to silence us. Personally speaking, that war was a media war. Massacres and the killing of the innocent was broadcasted live. I think that holding trials for Israeli leaders or issuing arresting warrants for them by some European courts was motivated by media records. There were warrants of arrest or deprivation of entering some countries. These courts depended on the testimony of journalists. Thus, Israel realized how dangerous a Palestinian journalist could be and what are they capable of to highlight the Palestinian cause and suffering. And also to show that war aims at killing the innocent and not ending the resistance, or terrorism, as they call it. The main goal was killing Palestinians. The bombing was random and shallow. They executed massacres, used white phosphorus, and burned people. No everyone was targeted in the strip, either directly or indirectly.
The Palestinian media is a part of the national Palestinian resistance. So everyone is engaged in those clashes. In every Palestinian confrontation during the past 50 years, journalists were in the front with people sacrificing their lives. They were a target of Israeli assassinations. Therefore, this is a historical evidence for the Palestinian media. Even during the last Israeli aggression on the Strip, a number of journalists were targeted and murdered.
I would say something my family may not like. I was destined to have a new life twice after the first and second wars on Gaza. If there's a third one, I will be a martyr. I keep wondering why I'm still alive up till now. I was facing death more than one time. It is the first time to come here after the war. Those memories are ugly, but at the same time, make us feel how strong we are. This place was bombed, and seconds later, we came here again. Some of us refused to get down. This makes me proud of the journalists of Gaza and Palestine, proud of the cameramen and work crews. We are really strong that a rocket was shelled here directly. We were standing here in this direction. We were shooting here with our cameras when the rocket fell here directly on this building. Of course, the destruction remains are still here of what happened in the war. Practically speaking, the moment I would leave home those days, leaving meant we were going towards death. However, when this place was hit by a drone rocket, we started waiting for the F-16 to come. Actually, we turned it into a joke between us and a good spirit. guys, where would the rockets come from? This direction or that one? This plane or that one? After all, we wanted to work and convey our message. We were scared, but we controlled it and got over it. I would feel I'm on duty and asked to go out and tell the world about what happens and shoot everything to transform the suffering of my nation. If I didn't do this, a mother would lose her children and the child would lose her family with no one knowing about them. Another woman would suffer regardless of being a mother or a sister or a daughter. At the end, it's a duty. It's a testimony for every female journalist in Palestine and Gaza in particular. They are strong. We have unbelievable determination that words cannot express, but we lived that a second time during the Second War. I also confirm that we're going to live the same if there happens any aggression on Gaza. None of the female journalists would back away. We became stronger with more experience.
Isdra has worked in this field since she graduated from university. She was always in the thick of the action. She is known for showing humanitarian news features to the world. Isra has won the award for the best TV correspondent in the Islamic world.
It was something great. I didn't know about that contest. Those people were following up with our work and reports and collected works of hundreds of female reporters and journalists all over the world. At the end, they decided that I deserve the title of the best female reporter in war covering in the Muslim world. I felt it was the first reward after the war. Rewards are not necessarily money or tangible. The idea of having such a title meant that people were following up with what I was doing and appreciating that I was going to death itself for the sake of telling the world that there is a nation being killed and cleansed. There's a nation witnessing the melting of its people by white phosphorus in front of them. I succeeded in delivering this message, and this was what made me happy the most after the war until now. I could deliver the message.
Lots of stories in Gaza, lots of telling stories in Gaza, and lots of people, lots of successful, lots of negative and positive. And sadness and happiness and tears and furs and lots of things that against life and come with life. It's our turn, it's our responsibility as journalists to work in all those and put it in one circle. And then they cannot say that, oh, because you're a woman, you're sexist and less. No, because I am a refugee Palestinian. I know how to speak in my issue and how to present my own issue. This is my issue. This is my homeland.
In the limelight. The head of the Texas Department of Public Safety admitted on Friday afternoon, 27th of May, that of course it was the wrong decision for armed police to wait for an extended period of time outside the classroom where the gunman in last Tuesday's school shooting was killing children and teachers without storming in. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Richard Luscombe. The piece is titled, Texas Police Made Wrong Decision Waiting Outside Classroom, Says Official.
In the United States, the head of the Texas Department of Public Safety admitted on Friday, 27th of May, that, of course, it was the wrong decision for armed police to wait for an extended period of time outside the classroom, where the gunman in last Tuesday's school shooting was killing children and teachers, without storming in. Police's updated timeline suggests that roughly 78 minutes passed from the time that the gunman entered the school building to when police officers finally entered the classroom where he was located. Meanwhile, students trapped inside the classroom with the gunman reportedly called 911, including one who pleaded, "Please send in the police now," as officers waited in the hallway for more than 45 minutes. Stephen McGraw, Department of Public Safety Director, shed tears and said at a tense press conference in Uvalde, Texas, where 19 young children and two school teachers were gunned down by a local 18-year-old, that there's no excuse for the failure of trained personnel not to have intervened sooner. At least 17 others were wounded, and the victims were all inside one classroom. At a separate news conference, the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, showed no sympathy for the controversy facing law enforcement in Uvalde, saying that local police officials had initially misled him about the speed and resolve of police officers' response to the mass killing at the Robb Elementary School last Tuesday. "I'm livid," Greg Abbott said. "My expectation is that the law enforcement leaders leading the investigation get to the bottom of every fact with absolute certainty. The families whose lives have been destroyed need answers that are accurate." The mayor of Uvalde, Don McLaughlin, also claimed to be confused about Friday's revelations about the police response. And without elaborating, he said his staff would make any change needed if deemed necessary after an investigation into the police's response to the mass shooting. Stephen McGraw, Department of Public Safety Director, Greg Abbott, Texas.